As the dust settles after the general election, what can we expect in these early days on health? What will a mission-led government really mean in practice? And where is the money going to come from? Well, with me to discuss all this, I'm delighted to welcome two very seasoned guests, John McTernan, who is Senior Advisor at BCW, a global communications agency, and former Director of Political Operations for the Labour government in 2005 to 2007. Now, John is a regular commentator on national politics and policy in the national media. And Hannah White, who is Director of the Institute for Government since 2022. Hannah previously worked across government, supporting select and legislative committees, amongst other things, and 2 years ago published her first book called Held in Contempt, What's Wrong with the House of Commons? Welcome both. I think the first question is, you know, landslide feels momentous, doesn't it? I just wondered, given that you both are such seasoned people close to government, what you have made of the last few days since the election result?
I think you see Keir fulfilling his promise to govern as he campaigned, which is being straightforward, opening up about the problem. So, you know, he was asked by The Sun newspaper at his first press conference, what do you think about the idea your prisons minister thinks a third of people aren't in prison? Instead of doing what a previous prime minister had done in the last 14 years, banged on about law and order, he said, I can't be into court loads of times. I've seen many, many people who shouldn't end up in prison. They should be diverged earlier on. And actually, he framed the whole issue without passing off responsibility for the prisons overcrowding crisis to the Tories. He framed the issue as a different one, a different approach to criminal justice. And I think that emphasis on prevention and diversion and intervention is probably going to be a tone and a style and an approach that this government will use more and more. So I think they start to govern as they intended. Keir's put an emphasis on meeting the first ministers in the devolved nations. He's going to meet the mayors as well. He's aiming all the time to be inclusive rather than divisive. And I think that's a pretty good start off for the whole process of a new government.
Yes, my takeaway from that press conference, one of them was his response to the question about Amanda Pritchard at NHS England, and just said, look, it's not about the chief executive of the NHS, this is about the previous government's record. So he was already just thinking in a wider context and not a sort of blamey kind of way. Also, the word straight away seemed to come across quite a lot in the press conference. So it was really sort of action oriented, wasn't it?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it feels very much like this is an action oriented government. It's all about first steps being taken as quickly as possible. You know, whole cabinet appointed on Friday, you know, real sense of purpose getting on with the cabinet meeting. I mean, I slightly differ from you, John, in the sense of I think the first appearance of Starmer in public now, he feels like a different man to me than to the one who was campaigning. He feels much more comfortable in handling the sorts of questions and giving the answers he now feels able to give in a way we can really see how constraining the Ming Bars was.
Yes.
Yeah. During the campaign, and now he's just sort of it's a much straighter bat, and that it feels like we're seeing more what he will be like as a prime minister. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, definitely relaxed, and definitely his authority derives from something different from hectoring rhetoric. His authority derives from a comfort that he finds of being in charge of, you know, a complex bureaucratic organization, a complex system. But he's managed complex systems before, and he's actually transformed complex systems before. So I think that's a very fair assessment of him. He just looked a different kind of leader, but a natural leader, and that does give him a different kind of eloquence in answering questions.
I guess one of the interesting things now is whether he really does what I think was the reflection of people coming in 97, whether he really makes the most of his moment of maximum power to make some of the difficult decisions he might want to make, whether those are about personnel, whether those are about structures, whether those are about priorities. This is the moment when he really has all the power in his hands, you know, across the government system, but also with his cabinet. So it's going to be interesting to see what those initial few sorts of decisions.
I totally agree with that, Hannah. I think I always say to leaders in any organization, when I do work with them on induction, you have more authority than you think you have when you come in, but less time than you think you have as well. So you really have to act.
I think it was Gus O'Donnell I heard saying, get some rest, you know, don't sort of go straight at it, which they've obviously ignored and gone straight at it. And we published a book a while ago where we invited all former Secretary of State for Health to just say, what advice would you give to a new Secretary of State? They all said, don't do things quickly, have a good think. There are some stuff you have to do quickly. And as you said, John, don't just hit the ground reviewing, hit the ground running. But there is a bit of a tension there, isn't it, to try to get the short-term things right, but not cut off possibilities for the future by getting some early stuff wrong.
People voted for change. They need to see change. So I think Rachel Reeves' announcement of the kind of framework of the planning review reform, that's really interesting because that should be the Deputy Prime Minister, the Secretary of State for DLUHC, Angela Rayner, but elevated to the Chancellor. It becomes, it's a down payment on growth. It shows the intent, it shows the intention. I think that sense of setting as much of the framework out as soon as possible in a strategic way to you know, the five missions, we know the top mission is growth. We know that growth contributes to all the other missions. Everybody who's ever worked in and around health learned a lot from the Lansley reforms. And
hopefully.
the desire to never, ever be put in that situation again, I think has been burnt in not just into NHS England and the people who run the trusts and all the people in the health service. I think it's very clear that Keir understands that, and that Sue Gray understands that, and that Wes understands that. So I think one thing that has been done well and badly under previous Labour governments is whether you bring the health service with you. One Secretary of State, however many junior ministers he's got, how many advisors he has, cannot change a complex organisation. So bringing people with you, letting them have their say. The one thing that I learned from David Plouffe, who was Obama's strategist, who took Obama to the presidency twice, David said, you do need to spend a lot of time on strategy and make sure you get everybody's views, everybody's voices. And when you get your strategy, stick to it, because a day or a dollar off strategy, it's wasted. Let everybody contribute, but never let the monkeys in the cheap seats throw you off your stride. And I think that's an important thing. You do need to take time, but you do need to be clear. I think Labour's approach is going to be this. We've got a mandate. It's not just a mandate for change. It's a mandate for change in particular key areas. We are willing to talk to anybody about ways to get this done faster, but we're not going to be diverted from our mandate to build more houses, to sort out the backlog in the waiting list, all of those things. So it's tight on objectives, but kind of more open on how to get to there, which I think is probably going to be refreshing for people.
I think it also depends a bit on the exact circumstances in which you come in, say, as Health Secretary. You know, Wes Streeting has had, you know, some time to think, to build relationships, to form his thoughts. It's not the same as coming in, you know, as we've seen so much in recent decades, mid-government, you know, to reshuffle or a snap election or something like that. So I think that balance between intention and moving quickly and talking to people and bringing them with you is slightly different in this circumstance. But the thing that's been interesting for me with Wes is how much his key message is around the NHS is broken. And obviously that is, you know, both understood by lots of people across the NHS, but also a difficult message when people are there and working extremely hard and doing their best. And it's clear that, you know, he feels that has to be a message which is understood in order to move on and to find the ways in which it can be solved. But I think what's going to be interesting is how the NHS and others respond to that. Do they kind of continue to say, you know, nothing to see here, in a sense, you know, no problems, it's all going as well as could be expected with the money we have available? Or is there more of a sense that opens up a space for discussion about what needs to happen, which maybe hasn't been there as much? I'm interested in what you think about that, Jemisa.
From the manifesto, we had a sort of shopping list. I sort of likened it in a blog to a sandwich with a filling, but the bread bits were missing. The two bits of bread were the investment levels promised, and the other bit of bread was the reform programme. I mean, clearly they've got some must-do asks that everyone realises they need to show progress on to maybe get cred for the longer-term investment. But in terms of the reform itself, what is the guiding star here for reform is just murky.
I think there's a real tension in the health agenda, if I'm honest, which is missions are the end of neoliberal approaches to governance. It's a fundamental break with the past. Posing the question, we have a problem, we've got a challenge, we've got an issue, what are we going to do about it? And the language of reform, however you use it, is not the language of transformative missions. The language of reform is, I've got something and I'm going to do it to you. And until that language issue is resolved, I don't think it'll become clearer what the actual health agenda is. Labour has relied actually on its advisors. You know, Simon Stevens as advisor eventually became chief executive, is the greatest example of it. But advisors have driven a lot of health policy as opposed to Department of Health or even NHS England. NHS England adapted itself to include some of the people who've been key advisors for Labour. But in that sense, we're in a funny situation where we it's not clear what the Labour agenda is for health, but it's clear what the public's problems are. And in within that, the language of reform does occlude. It is murky. And the making a mission into reality in the mission board may well be the process whereby you start to see how is a complex system going to change, because nothing in the end can be solved on its own. You cannot fix trusts, you cannot fix waiting lists. If you don't deal with social care, you can't deal with social care. If you don't deal with local government finance, you can't deal with local government finance if you don't deal with the council tax in the end. And so the interconnectedness of it makes it quite difficult to show much of the entire strategy. This is going to be emergent, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it feels to me that the sort of incremental set of steps that need to be taken across those complex interconnected systems, which John describes, in order to deliver long-term productivity gains across services. The point of the missions is that it should be about outcomes rather than inputs. That has been a bit contradictory, I would say, in what we've heard from Labour across the piece. You know, we've heard, you know, 6,500 teachers, you know, still talking about sort of frontline numbers, when actually at the same time, the point of a missions-based approach is about, say, you know, what is the longer term outcome? We don't know yet what the right way is to get there. There is going to be need everyone to work together across a system to deliver that outcome, and maybe frontline numbers will be part of the answer, but that is more like the old approach we've seen in recent years, and maybe that's inevitable. Maybe that's just a function of how you have to campaign. Wes Streeting's, you know, talked about numbers of scanners and so on, and capital investment is going to be a priority and is going to be a thing that people notice. So I think there's going to be a constant set of tensions to be negotiated, and maybe that's why we can't see an overarching organisational sort of narrative in the way that you're sort of looking for.
Is Starmer going to really chair these mission boards, or would it be Wes Streeting was more likely to take risks and want to do something bigger? How far could he prevail? Do we have any inkling of at the moment?
I always use the role that Keir played in changing the RUC into the PSNI, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, as the most interesting way of thinking how he'll deal with changing government. In one sense, because it shows you how he managed, how he led. And I think taking an institution which was distrusted by one community and turning it into an institution which is, you know, which is making its way and building trust in. Keir actually is the first prime minister I've seen for a very long time who's got a theory of change. And his theory of change is that you do need to change culture. Everybody says that, right? But you only change culture by making structural changes. The organizational form embeds behavior and embeds ideology. I wouldn't say that he ever goes this wide in saying it, but he has a theory of change, which you need to change the organizations if you want to change the outcomes. So I think the missions appeal to him for that same reason. If you simply run things the same way you've always run them, then it's less likely that you'll have changes. Now, how that then takes you into the health service, given that he doesn't say this, nor does Wes, but the dominant political discourse mediated through lobby journalists in the UK, acts as though we have one health service. We don't, not even in England, do we have one health service, really. I think the management of complex systems and change in complex systems is something that he has a theory of approaching, and I think that That's one of the things about the way he will approach it.
We've seen a lot of structural reform over the years. I mean, I started in policy in 1990. There's been so much. And I'm not convinced that any of it really made a massive difference, to be honest. And I think other things do make a difference more. Science, technology, data, you know, the development of medicine, communications, rather than structural organizational change, if that's what you meant there, John.
Crudely, and it is crude to say, since 1948, the majority of productivity improvements in the health service have been in terms of treatment. Biosciences, machine learning, just take those two, can assist with detection, prevention, and cure. So suddenly you're in a situation where the productivity achievement on the horizon, and you can see it in bits and pieces. And I think the way that Keir explained that they were going to implement the policy on appointments was to get people who are already doing it in parts of the health service to go to other people. Now, it seems simple and straightforward, but it's an observation, which is the William Gibson, the science fiction writer's observation, which is the future's here already. It's just unevenly distributed. And so, again, it plays to, he's not the flashiest of political figures, but we've tried flashy and that was a disaster. So there's something about using the missions, having the modest targets, admitting that we're living within constraints, accepting that there is a productivity issue, but it's not a product thing that we solve by, I'll do this to you. It's a productivity issue that's handled by us all working together. I think ideally they'd like to tidy up post-Lansley problems, but they're also very aware that overlapping with structural reform is the way to get everybody's back up in the health service, waste time and not deliver anything.
I mean, I do think structural change in the NHS may well not be the answer, and you two are much more expert on that than me, but I do think a change in the way structures work at the centre of government is going to be really essential if missions are going to work. And we've heard Keir Starmer at his first press conference say that he's going to chair these mission boards, that most of the actual, those sort of policy and delivery focus is going to be within departments rather than held at the centre so much. But I think it's going to be, you know, if missions are actually going to be a different way of doing government, then DHSC is going to have to work better and more closely with other government departments, the departments that actually have a massive impact on population health. You know, that's DfE, that's DWP, that's MOJ, that's Home Office. You know, it's actually, they all have areas of policy which are really, really important. And working together means not just sort of talking to each other, but it means a real change in the way money works in Whitehall. I mean, that is the fundamental thing. If the missions-based approach is not reflected in the spending review, then, you know, it's not going to make the difference it could make. Yes, it's about culture, but it is also about Whitehall processes as well.
So Hannah, just as we're on missions, could you just say a little bit more as to what you understand how they would work? So you've said Keir Starmer would chair, there'd be a board. We understand the board would be some external experts brought in, amongst others. So you've got them sitting in the centre of government, but then also there's a department that leads. So in the case of the NHS, obviously a Department of Health. But how would it work in practice then? And would the mission have a budget? How would that work?
The answer is we don't know yet, and we're waiting to see. And those are all the really key questions. And, you know, the important thing to bear in mind is that although the missions are broad, they don't by any means cover everything that the government will do. There's huge amounts of government which won't be covered by the missions. And actually, in fact, the health one, I think, is the one that sits most squarely within a single department. As you say, it's enormous arm's length body. But there's a danger in that. There's a danger in thinking this is something that DHSC is going to be sort of responsible for delivering alone. So we need to see. I mean, we don't yet know the answer to how the spending review is going to be handled, whether there's going to be a one-year one and then a more in-depth, longer three-year one. We've heard both things very firmly stated in recent days since the election. So that will be a really core thing. But yes, I think driving departments to put in joint bids into that spending review process has got to be a core element of making missions real.
Between 1997 and 2010, the Labour government halved child poverty and it ended pension poverty. And what is really interesting to reflect back on the last 14 years is ending pension poverty became a bipartisan consensus. And for all the railing against the triple lock, it actually has been a good thing to stop the state pension becoming nugatory, in the words of Michael Portillo, when he was in the Thatcher government, and becoming something that's a base on which people can live with dignity in retirement. But there was no political cost to the Conservative Party actually increasing rates of child poverty really substantially. So, you know, the working parents, kids with parents at work, they're in poverty. So there's something around establishing a framework that is robust and bipartisan and can carry on beyond the government. And for me, that links back to the point of the missions. And there's an openness about the missions, because that's how mission-driven government should be. That, you know, people should be contributing to the debate about whether there should be a one-year spending review followed by a three-year one. And the political logic of it is you definitely should do a one-year spending review, because spending, unless, if it's going to be a spending review, it needs to allocate fresh spending. It cannot be a cuts review. If the Labour Party has a cuts review, this is a one-term Labour government. There's no doubt in my mind about that. If the fiscal rules don't bend, then the government will break. There's something about accountability, responsibility, delivery as well in all of this, which should be open to a broader conversation, because, as you said, the National Health Service is part of a system which it can't determine the life opportunities of working class kids. The tone of Keir, the way he talked about policy, should be a way that people are keying into. Well, if that's how he talks about prisons, what does it mean for health? How should the missions work? And if he talks about devolution the way he does, well, what does that then mean about the mayors? What does it mean about local government? It's going to take a long time for us to realise we're free to think out loud, and that should be liberating.
One of the big mission hopes is technology. And there, I'm not sure a gradualist approach is necessarily going to be the right one. And I noticed what Tony Blair Institute is quite techno-ecstatic about technology. And it's a big hope. Are we really set up to take some risks here, which we will have to? And that leads to the spending review, because in a sense, it does take time to feel confident that you can take those risks. It's taking them within a year with a one-shot spending review done this year or later this year is difficult, because a lot more thinking needs to be done. I'm talking about technology that can sustain public services through service transformation as opposed to medicinal science.
A lot of health service internal administration is trying to get people, patients, to clinicians or clinics, to slots, matching a moving target, changing pressures on the individual to make things. And there's a sense in which there must be a transformatory internal admin solution by using machine learning. Patient transport has a first mile, a middle mile, a last mile. And we know that machine learning and AI have assisted algorithms, basically, have helped deliveries to come to our houses. There are new systems that have been built on around those. And that, I think this is one of the tensions, which is retrofitting existing institutions and systems is a lot harder. But there are productivity improvements, service improvements. We look at just the application in vaccines. And so, again, it feels as though the knowledge and the practice are there. And so how do you get that out, and how do you spread it? And I always caution politicians who talk about risk, because and civil servants too, because the one thing there's never any risk in doing in government is failing. As long as we're failing in the same old way, no one cares. What always gets focused on is failing in a new way. If you share an openness about what's really, what the problems are, the challenges are, then you can start to go, well, what could we do about this? And then it opens up a space where, if we're failing already, it's less of a risk to try something new.
The depressing reality when you think about technology in government is that there are lots of existing, really safe, really well understood technologies which aren't being used to maximum effect already in the public sector before you get to much more cutting edge, sort of risky type technologies. So, you know, I was very struck by a piece of work we did here at the IFG, where, you know, one of our findings was that GPs should be making better use of the telephone, which is not exactly a forefront technology. There's a lot of stuff around legacy IT systems. And obviously that's not cost-free, and there's lots of complicated, boring contractual issues around updating those. There's a lot that can be done without getting into the sort of the very forefront technologies. And then I guess the other point is just about sort of piloting and trialing things. But as John was saying, working out how to work out what's working where and then scaling it rapidly. And I think that is part of the mission's approach.
You know, there's one approach to tech, which is just, you know, free up innovation grassroots. And it's an American approach, you know, you just let 1,000 flowers bloom and the good ones will pass and but et cetera, et cetera. But there's another approach, also American, actually, which is national demonstrations, bigger bets, because time is short, because the morbidity wave is going to hit the NHS and demography is against us, et cetera. How bold are people going to do to grasp some of this stuff and say, we don't know if it's going to work, but let's try it because, you know, time is short. And
it's really important. It's not just the time is short. It's that patients untreated are living in misery sometimes. And that's that. There's real, at the end of this whole process, there's real people. And I think if the Labour Party does anything in health, it needs to keep putting people and their stories at the centre of it. That's one element of my thing. I think when Hannah mentioned the telephone, we still not fully exploited the benefits of telephone technology, and that comes in the 19th century. You know, there's a great book by a UK academic, which is The Shock of the Old, that actually old technology still has a lot to help us with, and we should never disdain old technology. The third element, which I think is really interesting, is I read a great piece by a colleague of mine who was saying you can use synthetic data to create synthetic profiles of individuals, and that has quite high rates of accuracy. Now, it made me think, we do in the private sector use digital twins of organizations to look at supply chains. I know people are working on doing a digital twin, the personnel side, to look at the human element of it. And I just think that a really practical use of investment in AI is not all the money that's being spent in Silicon Valley, but actually, what if you took some of the ideas that Hannah was talking about, the ones that are working, that you can scale up, okay, what about using a digital twin of particular parts of the service or particular regions or sub-regions, cities, to then look, what are the bridges and barriers? What are the blockages? Just run simulations. What if we could use run simulations to see in real time what a 4 or 5 year rollout might look like? And then it's between your national demonstration projects and your 1,000 flowers, but what about let 1,000 models bloom? And you know, that kind of opportunity, that openness might be helpful.
There's so many more questions I want to ask you both, but I've pressed on your time enough, I think. Thank you so much. Is there anything burning that you wanted to add at the very end?
When you were saying, John, earlier, and I said it's a really interesting point about how abolishing pension and poverty had become a kind of, you know, a shared consensus. And you know, all the evidence in the work that we've done at the IFG on long-term policymaking is that the golden thread, that the thing that really makes a difference in terms of long-term sustainability of government moving towards a goal, is that trying to achieve, you know, cross-party consensus. And I was reflecting as you were talking, John, that obviously for pensioners, that was a policy which came from a Labour government, but then was sustained by the Conservatives. And maybe electorally, that's very explicable because the Conservatives could see that for them, appealing to pensioners was, you know, was also something that they wanted to do because that's where their voter base is. Some of the narrative now around the Conservatives is actually what they need to do to rehabilitate themselves in the eyes of the electorate is to appeal to younger demographics, and maybe a smart new conservative leader might think that actually picking up on what you say around your child poverty and working age, that might be quite an interesting way to build a coalition with a new conservative administration, if that were ever possible.
And it fits with conservatives presenting themselves as the party of the family. There's so many ways in which they've taken policy positions over the past period. I wonder about, you know, why would you oppose equal marriage or civil partnerships, gay relationships, when actually there's the foundation, you know, marriage is the foundation of family, and family is the foundation of bourgeois society. I mean, what you made me think was, Labour does need to think in some of the reforms that are going to come, whether the road charging will have to become the proper taxation of domestic housing wealth to fund local government, social care. There's a whole set of areas where Labour should seek to entrench as much cross-party support for it. Being the government is no longer being in opposition. Not everything is about doing down the other guys. The other guy's record will live for a long time. You know, people will not forget Liz Truss or Partygate for a very long time. You can remind people about that, but it doesn't stop you making sure you get their votes for some big legislative changes, which can then be the welfare changes that create the new frontiers in the 21st century. I think it's my final thought would be, there's such a huge amount of possibility for health in our country and the health service in our country, and it's not simply having a change of government, but that does create a change of context. And we should never forget the freedom to dream. And I think we should all dream of a better health service.
So we must leave it there. Thank you very much to Hannah White and John McTernan for their really interesting insights today. Have a look at the show notes. We'll stick a few interesting links in there of writings by Hannah and John on the subjects we covered today, and not least the fabulous IFG report, which is on the centre of government, how it should change to achieve more progress. Meantime, thanks as ever to Leo and Sean at the Health Foundation, to Paddy and Jack at Malt Productions, and it's goodbye until next time from me, Jennifer Dixon.